Welcome back to the Educated Patient Podcast. I'm your host, Mike DeMarco, and today we're with Dr. Shapiro. Today we're going to discuss heart health and cholesterol. There's some new discussion and guidelines that have come out in the past year around cholesterol numbers, and it's always interesting on the patient side or on the everyday person side when these numbers get jumbled up and you think it's one thing and then it's another thing. And so I'm really excited to dive into this with Dr. Shapiro today. Thank you for joining us. Please intro yourself, give us some context, Dr. Shapiro, and we'll take the lead from there.
That's great, Mike. Well, great to join you today. I am a cardiologist, and my focus actually is on prevention of cardiovascular disease. Most cardiologists are seeing individuals who already have established cardiovascular disease, like a heart attack, a stent, or bypass. I do see some of those patients, but my focus is actually trying to take people who don't have heart disease and keeping them that way. And so I'm considered a preventive cardiologist. And one of the major aspects that preventive cardiologists are interested in is cholesterol, what we call lipids. And I've had the good fortune to be part of the writing committee for the new 2026 ACC/AHA cholesterol guideline, what we call the dyslipidemia guideline. And I know that's going to be part of the discussion today.
Love that. Were you always on the prevention side out of school, or was that something that you kind of grew into through your career?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, no. And I'll tell you, especially when I was, training, which was in the mid-2000s, there really wasn't an entity, a subspecialty known as preventive cardiology. It's really only coming into its own now. I mean, it's still in a very early stage. But, fortunately now, with all the developments in diagnostics and therapeutics, there is enough substance now to make it a subspecialty of cardiology. So now some of the young trainees are pursuing careers in preventive cardiology. But I actually did a traditional cardiology fellowship after internal medicine. And then after that, I did an additional 2-year fellowship in advanced cardiovascular imaging, where the focus was on cardiac CT and cardiac MRI. And I started my first position actually directing a cardiovascular imaging program. But much of what we do with cardiac CT is imaging of atherosclerosis, the hardening of the arteries. And I'm talking specifically of the heart arteries, what we call the coronary arteries. And so when you're looking at this cholesterol plaque day after day, many of us just naturally get more interested in understanding the underpinnings of atherosclerosis. And that got me more interested in lipids and prevention of cardiovascular disease. And so my career had gradually evolved more to the prevention side. And now I'm at Wake Forest University, where I direct our Center for Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease. And I do that full time, both clinically and research.
How much of the new, or actually, I think the first question that comes to mind is how often are these guidelines changing? Is
Yeah.
it every 2 years, 4 years?
Yeah. Up until now, there wasn't a set interval between guidelines. I can tell you that there was a major paradigm shift in our cholesterol guideline in 2013. It moved from essentially the NIH to the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology. And in doing so, the whole sort of structure of the guidelines changed quite dramatically. And so 2013 represented that first shift. And then there was the next guideline in 2018, so 5 years later. And now in 2026, so, even longer interval of about 8 years. But to your point, because the science and the evidence is evolving so quickly, there is now, a motivation to update these guidelines, maybe on a yearly or every other year basis. So not like brand new guidelines, but critical updates that would really change clinical practice. So I think that would be certainly welcomed.
The question I stopped myself on to ask the frequency question first was now I'm going to ask is how much of the most recent updates, yes, have to do with the speed at which new information is presenting, but how much of them have to do with some of the mindset shift that you mentioned experiencing on your side of the table, where a lot more of the mindsets are shifting to this preventative mindset? Did that have a lot to do with the most recent updates?
I think that's a great point. I mean, I would say the new guideline philosophically is quite drastically different and really moving, towards that prevention side. So that, when you read this new guideline, it's very clear that there's discussion and guidance about evaluation and treating individuals at a much earlier stage. We've typically waited too late, but there's a growing understanding, much of it due to advances in our understanding of genetics that really have made it crystal clear that if we're going to be successful in preventing cardiovascular disease, we had to identify individuals at risk earlier. And for some of them, we would need to start treatment also at an earlier age.
So, embedded in that philosophy or these new guidelines is this moving more in a direction of more individualized approach to diagnosing versus formerly in years past? It's like these are the numbers, this is the general trend for the overall population.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think the answer is generally yes, although that's not entirely new with this guideline. I think there was already a move towards trying to personalize risk assessment even in 2018, where this concept of risk enhancers was brought into the fore, meaning you might use a what we call a quantitative risk score, which is basically a risk calculator that gives you 10-year risk of heart attack or stroke. But it's a pretty crude estimate, so we need other information to try to refine that risk estimate. And in 2018, the guideline introduced this idea of risk enhancers, which are other factors that we know associated with risk, so that if they're present, you would sort of say that risk is even higher than whatever the risk calculator is providing. And then in 2018, there was, some guidance around the use of coronary artery calcium scores, which we can talk about if you wish, which is an imaging study. It's a heart scan that allows us to see if there's any cholesterol plaque buildup. But there's a much stronger endorsement for the use of coronary calcium scoring, and there's a broader array of risk enhancers that are provided in the new guidelines. So I do think, to your point, this does help us personalize risk assessment in individuals.
It's on the consumer side of the table that I sit, it's no secret that there's been a tremendous opening of access to blood panels at like extreme detail that formerly, like I would go for my physical, and if I asked for a blood panel, because I'm generally healthy, I would have to ask, hey, can I get a blood panel? And I would get whatever they were, 12 to 14. Now I could go on a website and have a phlebotomist at my dining room table tomorrow and have a 14-page report on these things that I've never even knew were possible. And I'm sure some of them are relevant to our conversation today, and some do some other stuff, but it just speaks to the way the world has evolved tremendously in the last 5 years, specifically with this stuff.
Well, if I might make a comment, Mike, on that, the guidelines in terms of these risk enhancers and whatever, imaging studies are recommended are really based on the strongest evidence that's available. You could get lots of blood tests, you could get lots of imaging tests, but they're not all equal in their quality, meaning not all of them have evidence of benefit. So, the guidelines really point in the direction of those that have been validated and show the most promise. So I would, while lots are available, having a healthcare provider maybe, guide somebody into, which tests you might want to consider versus which may not. You could spend a lot of money and you could actually not get useful information, or even worse, you could get, harmful information. So I would just add caution to that.
Yeah, I appreciate that note, because we are in the world of like information at our fingertips. Like it's become the expectation on the consumer side. I could just jump into AI and find any answer I want. I don't have to talk to my
Right.
doctor anymore, right?
Right.
But we still have to remember that you do need professional guidance and insight and validation and substantial evidence to support some of these things, and you can't just run with the wind in the next trend that's coming.
That's a great point.
In terms of the additional risk factors, the calcium score is something I've heard a lot about in the last few years. especially working in the fitness setting with, a male population, let's call it between 40 and 60, the calcium score has become something that's really prevalent. But the what are some examples of the additional risk factors that give more of a colorful context for you as the provider in diagnosing or even saying you're at a higher risk?
Yeah, good. So I would just make one comment, which is to say the calcium score actually allows us to do disease detection. So I wouldn't even consider the calcium score as a risk factor or risk enhancer. It's telling us what is actually going on in your heart arteries. So it's a little bit different than some of the other risk markers that are discussed in the guideline. And there are many, there are many that are discussed and recommended for consideration, but I would focus on, a couple. Probably the biggest change in terms of, biomarker testing in the new guideline is endorsing universal testing of lipoprotein(a) or Lp(a), which is an inherited form of bad cholesterol, and so circulating levels are largely determined by your genetics. So your genes don't change. So if you have a high level, you'll certainly always have a high level. The number may not be exactly the same from blood test to blood test, but in generally, we recommend it only once because if it's high, it's always going to be high, putting you at risk for cardiovascular disease. And if it's normal, it's always going to be normal. And we're actually late to the party in the United States. Several professional society guidelines around the world had already endorsed universal testing of lipoprotein(a). But again, it speaks to, I think, the rigor with regards to how we look at the evidence. But the evidence is really quite clear now that lipoprotein(a) really associates with risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and even valve disease like calcific aortic valve stenosis. And now there are many therapies that are being developed to target Lp(a). Up until now, we haven't had a therapy. And so that will be the ultimate test as to whether Lp(a) is truly causal of cardiovascular disease. Because if you have a therapy and you lower it and you reduce heart attack and cardiovascular death, that sort of is the linchpin that sort of supports the causality because we certainly have the epidemiology and the human genetics. What's missing is the RCT, the data, the trial data. So that's one. CRP, high sensitivity CRP, which is a marker of inflammation that was already in prior guidelines, but now it sort of gets its own discussion, and there's more evidence. And in fact, there are now in people with established, say, coronary artery disease, there are recommendations for the use of an anti-inflammatory therapy called colchicine. So CRP testing has taken on more prominence, and specifically high sensitivity or hsCRP, which is the cardiac CRP. But then there's a range of other, markers that are in the guidelines: consistently high LDL cholesterol, consistently high triglycerides, obviously, measures for diabetes, and many others. So, for the interested individual, you can readily find this, and it really is context dependent. So not everybody needs every marker, and that's another reason, to speak with your healthcare professional as to what testing does or does not need to be done.
So the first one you mentioned was genetic, right? It's something
Yeah.
that you carry with you genetically. The second one, it didn't sound like it was genetic. It's more so a result of lifestyle choices or patterns and behaviors and stuff like that, or any combination of the such, which I think I'm gonna lead us down that path now, which is considering how those lifestyle choices cause the second one, which is the inflammation marker, to rise, which is really just the sim the, when that number rises, that's the scoreboard of, hey, we need to dive into all of the things that are making this number rise up. So would love to just unpack some of the lifestyle considerations that go into that second marker that we could cause change on.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and in fact, the immediate recommendation for the individual who has an elevated hsCRP are lifestyle modifications. We don't necessarily treat it with medications. As I mentioned, there's an anti-inflammatory therapy that we use in patients with coronary artery disease, but those are generally people who have had, say, history of heart attack, or other, syndromes compatible with, established atherosclerotic disease. So for, otherwise healthy individuals, or certainly individuals who don't have cardiovascular disease, an elevated CRP doesn't result in a recommendation for a medication. It's really all about lifestyle change. The most important would be, and people who are overweight or obese would be weight loss. The adipocytes, the fat cells, as they expand, they tend to get sick, and they secrete these inflammatory markers into the bloodstream, and that readout is that hsCRP. And as people lose weight, the CRP goes down. So it's actually, it can be this virtuous cycle where people who are trying to improve their health and they lose weight and they see their CRP is actually coming down. There's, in other words, objective evidence that they're improving probably their cardiovascular health can be quite motivating. And that's not to give you the sense that we're constantly monitoring CRP from visit to visit, but certainly can be used in a baseline assessment of cardiovascular risk. And that can lead to, recommendations about physical activity, healthy diet, weight management, and that can culminate in reduction in CRP. To that point, everybody who's listening to this podcast have heard of these miracle drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, frequently used for diabetes and weight management. But as a cardiologist, we prescribe this also because the data is very clear that in appropriately selected patients, it reduces cardiovascular risk. It also improves kidney function, reduces liver fat. I mean, it does a lot of really useful things. But one of the proposed mechanisms of benefit of these drugs is not just directly on the weight loss, but they appear to be anti-inflammatory as well. And that is touted to be one of the ways that you see all of these, great results across different, tissues and different systems in the body. And to that point, you could say, oh, well, you see its anti-inflammatory effect because, as you just said, as people lose weight, CRP comes down. That's true, but you actually see the CRP coming down before there's the weight loss. So there is this independent anti-inflammatory effect of the GLP-1s.
I have a firsthand, well, I guess it's secondhand because it's a family member of mine. Their anecdotal experience from taking one of these drugs is like previously super inflamed, and they hadn't started losing weight yet. And within a couple of weeks, they were like, "I don't feel in my joints anymore." And it wasn't something that they expected. It was like an unexpected and. For somebody that's been battling weight for a long time, obviously they know they need to reduce the number on the scale. But when they can experience a win like that early, it gives them a sense of hope. And I imagine for many people, it's just the little spark that they need to say, "Oh, I can do this, but right? I can get out of bed."
That I think that's exactly right, Mike.
And yeah, I love that, that potential because in my line of work, I feel like at the end of the day, my job is to wake up and help infuse people with hope that they could do the thing that they need to do, whether it's weight loss or whatever it might be. And there's many things that you mentioned. These new developments in the medical world have been unlocking for people, and it's not just the GLPs. There's many other things out there.
Exactly right.
Where do you stand as we're talking about the lifestyle side? There's tons of conversations around fasting. I'd love to pick your brain on what your thoughts are around fasting with regards to heart health, cholesterol, inflammation, that whole discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the jury is probably still out, but until now, there are obviously short-term trials, and I'm assuming you're talking about intermittent fasting.
Yes.
There's certainly short-term trials that have demonstrated favorable metabolic changes, but whether that actually translates into sort of meaningful clinical outcome benefit, I think that remains to be seen, and that's a very hard trial to do. But I don't think there's enough evidence for us to specifically recommend that as something that individuals should pursue. I think the strongest data really is for Mediterranean style diets and plant-forward diets. And I say plant-forward because you don't necessarily need to be a vegetarian to enjoy the benefits of, reducing the amount of, animal protein you take in. But basically, the tenets of a healthy diet, just another way of saying this is, obviously portion control is one issue. And that t tends to be the biggest issue, I think, for most people. But then, substituting more plant-based options for animal protein, which tends to have a lot of saturated fat. The other biggie these days, as you know, Mike, is the amount of processed food that people are eating. So if people could eat a bit less, if they could eat more plants and less processed food, so if, basically eat real food, we tend to overcomplicate things and look at all the specific ratios of macros and micros, and I think it can be very daunting for individuals who aren't as enthusiastic about that kind of approach when there's some basic steps they can take. All that said, I think equally as important, or even more important, is physical activity. We talk about these different lifestyle factors as if they're equally weighted, and I don't think that's the case. Clearly, for the individual smoking, the most important thing they can do, more important than their diet and physical activity, is of course smoking cessation, which can be difficult. So I wouldn't say don't do these other things until you stop smoking, but that would be priority number one. But fortunately, most people are not smoking. So what's the most important thing you can do? My read of the literature is physical activity, because it does everything you would want sort of a prevention medication to do, right? It lowers blood pressure, it improves cholesterol and triglycerides, raises HDL cholesterol, reduces blood sugar, reduces the metabolic syndrome or diabetes. It promotes mental wellness, it enhances sleep. I mean, it literally does. If you could bottle this thing, if you could put it into a pill and bottle it, we would do it. But you just have to do the physical activity. And where some people may get, especially for people who are kind of middle-aged or older who haven't been doing physical activity for a long time, where they may get stuck mentally is they're imagining they have to do this really intense physical activity when then that's not the case. Most of the physical activity is quite modest. Mild to moderate intensity. We're talking about walking, but lots of it, and doing it more often than not. Most days of the week, it does require doing as much as you can. That said, because we can make perfect the enemy of good, any physical activity, if you're doing nothing, okay, any physical activity is going to be great, and it's going to really improve your health. So that's the message that I spend a lot of time talking to patients about.
Yeah, I love that message. I was literally walking and talking with someone I work with yesterday, and they're at the moment where they've blown through contemplation, pre-contemplation, and it's like there's nothing left to do but to just do the thing, right? And while we're talking, they're talking out loud to me in real time. They're revealing, or almost like having a realization in real time, where they, for so many years, the gap that's existed between them and doing the thing has really just been their belief in exactly with what you just said, which is, well, I can only do 5 minutes. I can only do 10 minutes. I can only do 20 minutes. I can only walk. So is it even worth it? When in reality, for 20 years, you've done less than 5 minutes. So yes, 5 minutes is worth it.
It definitely
And
is.
that mindset, I think, hangs up more people than you and I may even realize. It's just anything is better than something.
That's
Not
exactly
something is better than nothing is what I meant to say.
right. I completely agree, and the evidence bears this out. I think what's also very helpful, and I actually talk to patients explicitly, like we're talking about, to make them to make it clear to them that doing anything is going to be beneficial. But we also talk in terms of step count goals, because there's a big literature on this, and those step count goals can be tailored to given individuals. But it also moves the conversation away from this idea of like how intense does the exercise, how physically demanding does the exercise need to be, to, oh wow, if I just get this number of steps and it's going to have a benefit. There's very clear data on that. So I often prescribe step count goals to my patients.
How do you do that? Do you have them like buy a smartwatch? How do you go about that process?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so I mean, as you know, like most people do actually, or many people have a smartwatch. But if they don't, most people have, a smartphone, and there's a million different apps on the smartphone that can do step counting. So, they don't necessarily need to buy a watch to get their step count in, as long as they're taking their phone with them. And then if they don't, and there's people who don't have a smartphone or smartwatch, you can buy a very inexpensive pedometer in any pharmacy. So that's also something they can do. But I think the step counting, what I like about it is I can prescribe a number, so somebody has something to aspire to, and then patients know, like, as they're working to that goal, if they're meeting that goal. I think people really do much better with concrete goals, as opposed to say, like, oh, do a moderate intensity something a few times a week. Like, what does that exactly mean? Whereas you say, okay, I want you to do 7,000 steps per day.
Yeah, and let's take that. 7,000 seems to be the most relevant number these days. 10,000, you hear these stories about how it was a marketing scheme back in the day, and like the real number research is like 7,500 is the number. But I want to go back to what you were saying around like you brought up the smoking example, right? So in the instance that somebody, and I do this regularly, I can't tell you how many times I have someone sitting across and they're humming and hawing about how they don't have time for the gym or can't afford the gym. And then I ask them to open their iPhone and go to the health app, and they open the health app and they've never even logged into the iPhone health app before. And so in real time, they're entering their name, their age, their date of birth. Then I have them go to the steps and their eyes light up because for the last 7 years that they've owned this phone, every single step has been tracked and they never even knew it.
Well, and
And
along with that is they probably, if you were to ask them, how many steps do you think you're getting in every day? Most people overestimate it. I mean, I remember when I, many years ago, when I got the smartwatch and I imagined just like what my default step count would be. And then I actually started measuring it. It was different. And you see that it takes a lot of walking to get the step count goal.
yes. Yeah, and when you see the actual data in front of you, like you're saying, people need a hard and true goal.
Yes.
It's a wake-up call for a lot of people, and honestly, it's all that they need to get in motion. So I love that it's that simple. It's just
Correct.
identifying a smart, tangible thing.
Yep, exactly right.
I want to jump to screening and early detection because I think that's a crucial piece of this conversation, and we can't just talk about, oh, you're I want to bring us home there because that's clearly your lane of expertise these days is on the front side of this. So let's jump to screening and early detection, and I'd love to just start by understanding, for me, I'm 36 years old. In my head, I don't need to get screened yet. I'm 36 and I exercise regularly, but I would love to be enlightened and understand, like, how soon should we start screening? How regularly should we be screened for this type of stuff? And am I out of the equation because I'm, in my eyes, I'm fit?
Perfect questions. Well, let's start at the very beginning. I mean, there are recommendations from, three US-based professional societies that have said this for a long time. This is not new, but that all children between the ages of 9 to 11 should have a cholesterol blood test. Not kids from a high-risk family, not kids like this or that, all children. And the reason for that recommendation is there is a relatively common inherited high cholesterol condition, which we call familial hypercholesterolemia. That just means high cholesterol, but very high cholesterol that runs in families. And if not identified and treated early, they're at very high risk for early onset cardiovascular disease. And so that's about 1 in 250 people, which doesn't sound that common. But when you compare it to other, what we call monogenic single gene disorders, which are often 1 in 300,000, 1 in 30,000, in that range, 1 in 250 now becomes quite common. And so, there's millions of people who have this condition. And if you identify it early, you can sort of bring that individual's risk for cardiovascular disease down to below average, But it requires identification and treatment. So 9 to 11, and then around 18 to 20 would be, as an adult. And if your numbers are okay and you're otherwise in good health and considered to be at low cardiovascular risk, then doing a lipid screening, a cholesterol blood test every 5 years is appropriate. Now, starting at the age of 30 years old, and this is a major change in the current guideline, starting at 30 years old, you need a proper cardiovascular disease risk assessment. That used to be stipulated at age 40. We used an equation called the pooled cohort equations that would sort of calculate or estimate your 10-year risk of heart attack or stroke. We now have a better, more accurate equation called the PREVENT equation that the American Heart Association published in 2023. And it's now the risk equation that has been incorporated into this cholesterol guideline. And that starts at the age of 30. And it takes into account, your age and your sex and your total cholesterol and HDL cholesterol and your blood pressure and whether you have diabetes, whether you smoke, all of those things. And it gives an estimate of your 10-year risk. But also for people between the age of 30 to 59, and this is crucial, it also gives your 30-year risk. Because most young people, 30, 35, 40, so on, most of them are going to have an extremely low 10-year risk of heart attack. But we're worried about people developing a heart attack in middle age and older. And so the 30-year risk gives us some insight as to what a lifetime risk would be. And now we had that with the pooled cohort equation, but there weren't then any recommendations tied to the numbers. Now this guideline says if your 30-year risk is greater than 10%, 10% or greater, to have a heart attack or stroke in the next 30 years, even if your 10-year risk is low, then they're making recommendations about, medical therapy. So that's a new development, and I think it's a move in the right direction.
Interesting. And I don't know how true this is or not, but I've heard this in the past from guys that are older than me, and they would always say to me that there's this magical number. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but let's just call it 50. And they're like, if you just make it past 50, your risk of heart attack or something like that decreases tremendously. But there's this bracket between the age of like 46 and 50 where that's like the hot zone.
Well, that's correct, which is to say that there is data, and Donald Lloyd-Jones really was the leader in this area, where he studied this. Basically, it says if you make it to the age of 50 and you have no cardiovascular risk factors, right? If you're optimal in every way, right? Your cholesterol is good, your blood pressure is good, you don't have diabetes, you don't smoke. So everything is looking good. If you make it to the age of 50, your lifetime risk, the remainder of your life, extremely low risk for developing cardiovascular disease. However, at least based in the US, the proportion of individuals who actually meet that criteria, meaning getting to age 50 with no cardiovascular risk factors, is incredibly low. So, it takes a lot of being very conscientious from a young age, with lifestyle and also winning the genetic lottery, right? Not everything's a lifestyle. There are genetic liabilities that some of us inherit that even if we do everything right, we do have increased risk. So we can't just blame ourselves.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which is important to remember because in 2026, the year of biohacking and doing everything perfect, you can't biohack your way out of your genetic lottery.
Correct. Correct. Well, what I think that's true, but I would also say that even if you inherited this genetic liability that's putting you at increased risk for cardiovascular disease, it would be good to identify, and then there's really productive things that you can do to largely mitigate against that risk that you've inherited. So, DNA isn't destiny. So I don't want people to leave, oh shoot, I inherited this. I have high LPA, for instance. That's an inherited bad cholesterol. It's just by destiny. But that doesn't mean it's a fait accompli, like, okay, I'm gonna get a heart attack at a young age. No. The recommendations are gonna be to eat well, maintain a healthy weight, be physically active, never smoke, and let's make sure that we have your LDL cholesterol lower than we would normally suggest. We'll be
Yeah.
more aggressive. Make sure that blood pressure is meticulously controlled. Make sure we don't develop diabetes. And you can mitigate against much, not maybe all. I mean, there's going to be still risk related to that, but you can still do very good things to significantly lower your risk, even if you have a genetic predisposition to cardiovascular disease.
I love that you followed up my statement with that because there it's so I think it's more of a default than not for the human brain to see a high LPA you're saying, right? And go victim mindset with it. And it's like, woe is me. I have this thing. I can't. It's like, no. That's more of a reason or an opportunity to focus on doing these things optimally all the time.
To that point, Mike, one of the most gratifying things that I can do that means so much to me is, for instance, I see a lot of individuals with this inherited high LDL cholesterol, high bad cholesterol called familial hypercholesterolemia. We say the abbreviation FH, much easier to say. This is the condition that's 1 in 250 in the population. So there's a lot of people with this. So these individuals have high LDL cholesterol, from birth, basically. And so if they had childhood screening or early adulthood screening, you'll see the LDL is very high. And what many of these people have heard, because every time they get a cholesterol test, their LDL is high, and maybe their healthcare provider says, oh, you need to work harder on your diet and you need to do more physical activity. And they do, they're really earnest. They know about this and they're worried about it. And they're left to believe. And actually, I've heard stories of doctors actually telling them, oh, you're lazy or you're not working hard enough. And they really start to feel bad about themselves. They blame themselves. So one of the most gratifying things that I have the opportunity to do when I see these individuals is to correct the record, to make sure they understand, no. It has nothing to do with your behavior. Okay, they still want you to do everything right. Okay, it's very important, but you inherited this. And it can be quite liberating for people to hear that for the first time. Oh, it's not my fault. You can't believe how many times I've seen that.
Yeah, and I can only imagine how many people internalize that and allow that to just ball and chain their brain
100%.
for the rest of their life in many ways, not just like it starts here, right? And it just goes everywhere because that becomes your perspective or your operating system.
That's right.
Great conversation today. I want to wrap with one question to leave the patients and the listeners with. From your lens, what's one thing you wish more patients understood about preventing heart disease?
Well, Mike, it really starts with the numbers. We were talking about goals, for instance, step count goals, which can be very helpful for patients. They have something to shoot for. It can be motivating. It's tangible. Well, prevention starts with knowing your numbers. What is my LDL cholesterol? What is my blood pressure? What is my blood sugar? Incredibly important. Until you have a objective evidence of, whether these things are, in the optimal zone or if they're elevated or extremely elevated, you're not going to have a sense of what your risk is, what you need to do. So I would say the most important thing is to know your numbers.
Love that. Where can we find you? Books, websites, articles.
Oh, you know what? I think probably the only place is on X, and that's at Dr. Michael Shapiro.
Great. Dr. Shapiro, thank you for an amazing conversation today. I learned a lot. I need to get some tests done personally.
Got to
And
know
for
your
those of you
numbers,
listening,
Mike.
I need to know my numbers. As a guy that, in his head doesn't like to know his numbers for finance. When you say know your numbers, it makes me cringy. But it's very important is my takeaway today. So know your numbers. But Dr. Shapiro, I really appreciate today's conversation. For those of you listening, if you want more information on this topic or other topics, please visit theeducatedpatient.com and stay tuned for more podcasts coming in 2026. Have a great day.
Thanks very much.